Hello, this is Benjamin Boyce, and welcome to my YouTube channel. I've been working, as you probably know by now, on an ongoing series on gender, sexuality, and transition. And this has led me to meeting a plethora of individuals with a diversity, a true diversity of ideas and experiences. And today's interview is with Kate from Australia. Now, what happened to Kate was that her body produced a tumor that secreted androgens into her system, androgens being the male hormones. This caused her to go through a natural, quote unquote, transition unbeknownst to her. So this interview is about that experience of having that tumor, of undergoing that transition, but it also gets into her struggles with identity and trying to erect a sense of self and how the categories of identities formed kind of markers for her to develop within, and then how she eventually got beyond those, you know, those categories into being a more true, authentic self. So that all said, here is Kate.
And how did you find my work then?
I don't know. I was having this conversation with one of my friends the other day, because he was saying how you're shadow banned or something. What was it?
Yeah. Google's doing something weird.
Yeah, something weird. They're always doing something weird. I think because I was watching Peak Resilience project videos, as well as other female to male detransition videos, and I guess through the algorithm you may have shown up because you were doing interviews with the people I'd already been watching.
And why were you watching detrans videos?
I want to understand it, and it felt like being able to understand it might help in my own situation. I don't really know how to go into it.
you have a very specific, had a very specific condition that I think I've even spoken with, or at least read about, where you had a tumor that was secreting male hormones into your body.
Yeah, androgens. I did write notes to keep myself on track. It was like mapping my life out since I was 17.
Oh, really?
It was crazy. Yeah.
And so 17 is when you first felt the effects, or when it was first diagnosed?
Neither. It was more coming from a point where, I guess, identity issues started transpiring. In regards to like questioning sexuality and my place in the world, I guess. So I've never really had like a fixed sense of identity. Like I grew up in a small town where I think a lot of people tried to be like everyone else. So a lot of conforming. I also grew up as a triplet. So I have a sister who we don't know if we're identical, and I have a brother. So we're like the three that shared a womb. I think so trying to separate myself from that, or at least find myself, like find a sense of individuality away from that, was something that came to light probably around when I was like 16, 17. Yeah, I think I was always trying to find my own way, but, you know, never really being sure.
You use two terms, and this is kind of an interesting tension between separating yourself or distinguishing yourself and finding yourself, which doesn't necessarily have to do with being different than everybody else. It's kind of just initiating a process of discovery rather than a definition. And we all go through that, especially during that phase, and like trying both of those ways and trying on a lot of different masks. Did you, looking back on it, what was that process like for you?
The process of finding
discovering
myself.
Or separating yourself.
Difficult. Process was difficult. Being labeled as something from a young age, like, oh, like you're a triplet. And then that kind of informed my identity in a way where it was kind of like the first thing I would think about if I was to meet someone new, and, you know, how people want to get to know you. It just felt like that thing that, the like in an icebreaker, you know, when
they're like, what are the odds of that? Do you know the odds of being a triplet?
No, I don't know the odds per se, but there aren't many in like my region, or you don't hear about it often. And it's not like my parents or family ever tried to make it a thing. I think my mum was quite more concerned with letting us be individual. But like I was saying, like growing up in a small town, only having, say, in primary school, one class for the three of us, it's very hard to separate and, yeah, be able to find yourself at the same time. So it probably wasn't until I moved away from home when I went to university. I moved probably like 2 hours away where I live now. My family don't live close to me. That I realized, because I didn't move with my brother and sister, or people didn't know me. It was like this whole new world, I guess.
Was that easy to be away from your family? I mean, being in a triplet situation, I don't know how the mind works in triplicate like that. I can kind of understand like a twin kind of processing, but was that a whole bunch of liberation, relief?
I think it was like I didn't have anything to rely on anymore. Like it was me. And I had to, I think, distinguish myself and not always fall back on like a label.
Okay, this is a personal question, but you brought it up and we can treat it as you want to treat it. But you mentioned like the sexuality component and defining yourself sexuality and where that intersects with an identity. If that was an easy way to say this is what I am, and then I can make a who after I figure out what I am. Was that something that was going on?
If I'm following where you're going, it was quite difficult to ever ascertain some sense of sexuality for myself.
As in desire of another?
Yeah. So, I mean, in primary school, so primary school is your elementary school, I think.
Do you have a grade or an age? I guess we can just use ages.
It's like, 9 to 12, that bracket of, and I don't know what kind of actual real feelings were behind it, but that was kind of the age where my friends and stuff, they were all like, oh, I have a crush on this boy. And like, they'd send notes to each other, all that kind of stuff. And I did that too. And I don't think there was ever really any real feeling behind that, like being a 9, 10, 11, 12 year old. Like, I don't know what kind of real desires ever behind.
What captured your attention while everybody else was playing the pre-dating game? Like, what would you get fixated on?
I don't even know. I think I joined in with it. I think I became a part of it. So moving into high school, I think that's, even then, like with friends, and they started like dating or talking to or whatever to like boys at school or boys in the area or something. And I don't know, I was never really interested in it. I think I liked to pretend I was interested in it, but never really followed through with anything. Like, even if I was like, oh yeah, like I'm talking to this boy and like I like him, but like, I think I was at that moment, following the crowd, a bit of a sheep, but I think I was still looking for ways to like define myself and understand myself. But this time of my life gets kind of muddled with like mental health stuff and like anxiety and depression. I think I was becoming quite like self-destructive in a way by like not sleeping well or self-harming or not taking care of my body in terms of nutrition or health.
But were you, some of the young women that I've spoken to, they would get heavily invested in the internet during
that
time.
That's what I'm going into.
Were you very invested in that virtual life?
Somewhat, yeah. So this was about the time where I think I got my first computer. and we'd always just have a family computer, but that was, sorry, I don't know if you can hear my notifications going off. And I think I got onto Tumblr, I knew about it, I think when I was like 14, 15, and I made an account. I don't remember why. I think it was that sense of anonymity, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What kind of society did you find there, or what kind of? I don't really understand Tumblr. Mm-hmm. Tumblr, but you can kind of assemble a news feed, right?
Yeah. Correct. I think I got into it was a lot of mental health stuff, but I say mental health in that. I think the people I was following were experiencing similar issues to myself. So it was quite, I don't know how to describe it. Like people feeding off one another, it almost seems like. Like venting their issues, and there's always stuff about like triggers and, you know, I think a lot of people venting about family and friends not understanding them, or there was a lot of secrecy involved as well, like these people I followed not wanting people to ever find their accounts for obvious reasons, because they're posting about like say self-harm or eating disorder related issues of concern. Yeah, a lot of secrecy, privacy, and but I think it was like a community, like feeding off of itself, like it's young people like all sharing this space and talking about things, and I think almost an element of competition, like who had it worse, who's got the worst behaviors. Yeah.
So the themes that you invested your attention into were more dramatic kind of eating disorders and teen angstiness.
Yeah. And... yeah. Like to give you a visual, it was all just like black and white themed blogs and all this dramatic stuff, angst. All of it.
And but like you said earlier that you didn't express. Did you express yourself too? Did you join in and write posts?
I found it difficult to write posts. Like I would do like reblogs and stuff, but I always found like every time I would try write something personal, I just delete it and not really engage. I think I was looking for something. I don't know what I was looking for, but. Yeah, I never really felt comfortable sharing intimate details. Maybe because I didn't understand it, or I'm not really sure why.
But was there an element of satisfaction in seeing other people's details? Is that what
yeah,
was there like? Were you getting some sort of gratification out of that, or do you think that it was helping you to understand yourself more? Or?
Yeah, I think there was an element of like confirmation and reassurance. Like it was some sense of like gratification from it in a way. But I think it was also quite enabling at the same time.
So, in what way?
In the way that kind of probably links to what I was saying before about that element of competition. Like I guess it's hard to tell if, I mean, I know I was already struggling within myself, and I think self-harm became a way of expressing myself in ways that words could not. Because I never really felt like I could verbalize these things, and maybe it became a sense of an outlet. But I mean, enabling in a way that other people are doing it, I can do it too, and I can get away with it. And there was this way of, oh, here's how you can hide it.
So you did hide it then. So it was kind of like you made a kind of a safe room built out of discomfort, perhaps.
Yeah, like the whole, covering my body in a way that I would disguise scars, which it became quite a focal point of my thoughts. I think always thinking about that and like, but at the same time, that element of just wanting someone to know, but not wanting to say it. Yeah. So it's an interesting mix.
When did you start to shake that off?
Like stop engaging the behaviors, do you mean?
Yeah.
Like stop self-harming? I don't know, maybe. Oh, like it was throughout high school, and I think I sort of stopped near graduation, maybe. I was like, oh, you know, I'm over this. Or I mean, I don't mean it so nonchalant, like I was probably processing it at the time, but I think also just I had those concerns about if I was older and looking back on it, would I regret it in terms of making changes to my body? Like, scars are permanent, I guess. Sounds fake deep, but...
This is going to be one of my most edgy episodes ever, just like, you know, I can feel it.
Edgy as, that's me.
We're going to have to do this in four panels. That's what I'm going to
do. But then I guess I re-engaged in those behaviors at university. I think when I had, again, that sense of independence and... but also struggling within myself at the same time and not being able to express that, I think the behaviors returned. But that lingering thought of still just, I think, wanting help but not knowing how to get it.
At university, and again, feel free to disregard this, did you add any experimentation with substances to the things? And was that another outlet, or how did that go?
So there was like a real culture of drinking alcohol. A lot of our social activities, because I lived in like a dorm situation, like I lived on campus in like this building with like 50 people in it. And I think probably like three times a week, it was the norm to drink or go out or just chill, but also drink. I got tired of that pretty quickly. typically. But I think that's when I started smoking marijuana quite frequently. Other people had access to it. And I enjoyed it more because there was less of like a, well, I saw it as less of like a health consequence than alcohol. Like, alcohol makes you put on weight. And that was kind of something I was trying to avoid. So, and I liked the effects of marijuana more, I guess. I think I was quite anxious in that environment with a lot of people that I don't really know, but I also felt quite different in comparison to. So I think using substances helped me cope with the fact that I didn't really feel like I fit in with this idea of, like, I guess, popularity.
And so, like, you left the small town so you could be different, but then when you got to the big city, you didn't want to be different anymore. It was really difficult to
So
fit in that
point. I think, yeah, definitely. I think I wasted a lot of time trying to fit in with something that didn't really fit me. But I found some good people. I found some cool people. And I think around the same time, I found like the group of people, more like my home base of friends. I think that's when I was like, oh, I want to actually explore, at least come to terms with sexuality. Mm-hmm. So in high school, I think that was when I started to question it more. I didn't, there was like this thing, like, I would find out, say, like, a guy had not feelings for me, I wouldn't go that way of saying, but like, was interested in like dating me, or I think, yeah, had some sense of attraction towards me. I'd find that out and I would just like detach completely. like I didn't want a part of it. And
did you think that it would be a game with no worthy conclusion to it, or did you not see it as an opportunity to get to know somebody better, or was there this other?
I think I was just so scared. I was so insecure. Deeply insecure that even if I was to pursue something and be on the same page as someone, I don't even know how far it would have got before I disengaged. Yeah. And I think at the time I took that as a sign of, hey, I might be gay because I'm not responding to this well. Like, I'm detaching from my male counterparts. So I think I was looking deeply into what that could mean for myself. Like, I was like desperately trying to like look for evidence in my life or my childhood, reasons why I may or might not be gay.
And if you knew that, why would that matter? Would that give you a sense of a claim to being yourself?
I think I was really wanting to look for an objective truth, to be able to say objectively, this is what I am. Yeah. Like, it wouldn't have made any difference, like, looking back on it. But at the time, it felt, like, really important for me to know at the same time. Like, and it's not like at that time I was unaware of the fact, like, bisexuality is a thing, that you can have feelings towards both sexes. But for me, I think I wanted something, I don't know how to describe it, but, like, yeah, objective and total and one side. And but for some reason I didn't want the other side of it being heterosexual. Like, and this links to, like, a lot of identity things. And I've made, like, some hypothetical conclusions about myself. And, like, growing up, like we're saying at the start, being a triplet and that sense of uniqueness in a small town, and maybe throughout my life trying to seek that kind of uniqueness all over.
And to stack it on top of itself.
Yeah, exactly. Like the Special Olympics or something.
Yeah. Well, the very special Olympics, yeah.
The very special.
But you said earlier that there wasn't, well, this is the impression that I got, that there wasn't a lot of desire moving you towards one direction or another. So were you seeking desire, or were you missing that? Did you look at everybody else hooking up and say, why am I not moved to do that? Is that?
Yeah, I think so. I think I was quite, like I was saying, reserved, but also embarrassed in maybe a lack of experience. So while in high school, my friends were going out and meeting people and dating and probably having, like, their first times for things. Mm-hmm. I was still, quite reserved. But I think the nature of my personality ultimately made me feel like I was behind the scene, in a sense. But there wasn't really much strong desire in wanting to follow that. I kind of just wanted it to conveniently fall in my lap. Like, I didn't want to actually have to go about and do it. So when I was in university and I was like, okay, I want to take this more seriously, I remember, like, downloading, like, a Tinder account or something, but never really wanting to take that seriously either. I think it was more like my friends being like, you should do it. Like, because I moved to a larger city, but even then it was still quite, not as progressive as other parts of the country or state. So I think Tinder became like an alternative to, I mean, what I'm trying to say is it's hard to meet gay people in real life. Okay. That felt very uncomfortable for me at the same time, because like I was saying earlier on, I found it quite difficult to express myself on like these kinds of formats. I'm concerned with the way I come across to people, like, say, with a message when I'm typing, or when I'm not in, like, a physical space, I'm worried about how I'm being perceived and interpreted, and ways in which things can be misconstrued.
So that was an avenue of self-discovery, but, and there was some social pressure from that and some internal pressure from that, but it didn't really amount to much.
Yeah, I think until it was like the next year. So I don't know what compelled me. I ended up meeting up with this girl who I met on an app, not Tinder, but more like a lesbian style of Tinder. And that was probably like one of the first people I talked to who I was more serious with actually like going through and meeting. And we ended up dating for like a few months. And I think
Was the goal to experiment, or was the goal to be intimate with somebody emotionally or mentally or physically? Like, what was the, what would have been the achievement state of that at that?
Yeah, at that point I think I was becoming more and more concerned with my lack of experience. And I think I was just trying to tick boxes. I don't think I was actually ever really sounds harsh. Interested in like an emotional connection, maybe, like, because I was so emotionally closed off at the same time, like, what emotional connection am I going to get from someone if I'm not willing to do the same?
Okay.
So while we knew each other, it was casual. In hindsight, I'd probably categorize it more as like being friends. Like, we were intimate with each other and we did have sex, but I was always still quite uncomfortable with that. So again, that component of worrying about how I was being perceived and feeling exposed, but also quite ashamed of my physical form at the same time. So we only dated a few months and things fell apart naturally, as they do. There was no animosity. We're still friends now. We still talk. But I think after that, because one of the reasons we kind of disconnected in a way was our individual mental health needs. So like I was saying, I don't know, I was still probably quite just self-destructive in a way that I was still smoking marijuana a lot, and not really taking interventions seriously, like antidepressants, like medical interventions, I guess. And
did you, looking back now, you see that as something that you should have been taking seriously?
Maybe not antidepressants, but I probably should have been taking other means of help seriously, like psychologists. So I would start seeing a psychologist, wouldn't click with them, move on, but would never really discuss why it wasn't working. I would just kind of not show up, and that was that. There was never really any more conversation on that part.
What was prompting you to go to the psychologist in the first place? Was it the way that you're treating your body? Was it a feeling of disconnection or darkness? Or could you describe that which you wanted to deal with?
I think I was still trying to find that objective truth in regards to my sexuality. And I thought being able to talk to a professional about it might help me navigate where I was. And I think maybe I was trying to look for validation in a sense. Like, I thought I came to the conclusion I'm a lesbian, and I'd still have those doubts, but I think I chalked a lot of those doubts up to be about, I think there's always going to be a sense of doubt when it comes to these kinds of things. I think I just wanted validation in that, you know, these doubts are normal. Trust your feelings. Like, I don't know what I was looking for. But I think, I was still struggling a lot with perception, body image, like how I was treating my body. And I think I wanted to, seek help in regards to that as well, even though I wasn't really taking it quite seriously. Like, with the second psychologist I started seeing, like, she was, looking back on it, very helpful and had great ways of viewing anxiety more from, like, a physiological standpoint, like the nervous system and how, what your body is actually doing when you're feeling anxious and ways you can manage that. So I hadn't had that before, but I don't think I was really willing to improve myself at that point. But I don't think I was really wanting to improve upon myself. I think I didn't want to have to stop doing what I was doing in terms of like being self-destructive. Like, it felt comfortable, I guess. Edgy. But that's sort of about the time I dropped out of uni as well. So I wasn't, at that time in my life, really doing much. I wasn't working. So I don't know what you have in the States, but we have like a, it's called Centrelink, basically. And you basically get money from the government if you earn less than a certain amount per year, or if you're a student, or if you have a disability. Like, there's, I mean, it's not really enough to live life lavishly, but it's enough to, for some people, to get basic needs met. So I guess I was just like, I'm not going to go to work. I don't need to. I'm just going to sit at home and I'm going to smoke weed and I'm going to forget about my problems or continue with my problems.
Did that help?
No. No, but I'm thinking back on it, like, I probably was using it, like, I guess, substances to deal with the fact, this is where it kind of gets into, like, all this stuff that happened with my body and tumor and such. I think I was using it in a way to cope with the fact that I didn't know what was really happening. Like, I knew I felt, I was really anxious. And again, like, those issues of not knowing what I looked like and how I was being perceived and that being on constant replay in my head.
Hmm.
But that's about the same time I think I noticed that I had more hair growth, in a sense, like facial hair growth or body hair growth,
mm-hmm.
which I think I rationalized as...
the dank weed.
I actually did think about that one time, but no. I think that was just the paranoia of smoking. No, more of... because I was still like a young adult. I am still a young adult, but I was younger then. And I think I chalked it up to be like, oh, this is just puberty doing its things. Like, I'm still developing. So hair growth, as much as I think it's like, compared to my friends who have like finer hair or maybe not as obvious hair, I was like, oh, it's okay. Like, we're all different in the genetic game. Like, yeah. So I think it was different if I was like 30. And I'd finished developing and noticed like an increased hair growth, I would have been like, something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But because I think I saw it as like a natural part of my development, I kind of ignored it or at least played it off to be normal.
How did that square with your constant obsession with your body and your appearance? That seems like there's a contradiction there where you're shrugging off a difference that might drive other people up the wall.
What about a difference? What do you mean?
Just the way that your body was going is kind of getting a little off the beaten track for the female body. But you, at the same time that it's doing that, you're justifying that, but you're still obsessing about your body at the same time.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So I was obsessing about it. And when I went, this is when I started seeing a psychologist who I was referred to by a GP who, the GP knew this psychologist was a lesbian. Because I went to my GP and I was like, I think I'm struggling with my sexuality. Like, I just don't know what it is. And she was like, hey, like, we've got this psychologist in our center who's a lesbian. Like, do you want me to refer you? And I was like, yeah, that'd be good. We can work through some stuff. And she was great. She never, like, pushed an agenda. Like, I think she was just more wanting to understand me and not just the sexuality component. But she diagnosed me with body dysmorphic disorder, which has similar traits to obsessive compulsive disorder. So there's an obsession with the body, or maybe a fixation on a certain aspect of the body. So for some people, they might view their nose, for example, as like hideous and ugly and huge, and they'll want plastic surgery to alleviate those feelings of distress. People with like body dysmorphic disorder might engage in like hair pulling or something like to alleviate stress. So pull at hair. And I was doing that, but I was pulling a lot of like facial hair or something.
It was a very specific sort of hair that you had there. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I saw that more as an anxiety release rather than I was actually trying to hide the part of me that I didn't want there. Hmm. So probably the ways I would talk to my psychologist, it was always like, I guess, distress about perception and body image, and I would like obsessively try look at myself in mirrors or reflections or taking photos of myself, just trying to like understand how other people could see me. But looking back on it, because my body was changing so rapidly, of course I was going to have difficulty in
accepting
knowing what I looked like. It's hard to know what you look like, and in the end it doesn't really matter, but I was quite obsessed with it.
So you got diagnosed with body dysmorphia, and what was the treatment for that? You have to do 10 sit-ups in the morning and 3 chin-ups in the evening, or how do you...
There wasn't necessarily a treatment. I think it was more go to therapy, keep talking through it. But like I was saying earlier on, we get 10 free sessions, and I reached the end of my 10 free sessions. And I was working at this point, actually. I did get a job, but it wasn't enough where I could really justify spending like $200 to see a psychologist. So although I'd been diagnosed with this, once those sessions ran out, I didn't really have much access to professional help. But I think I did try to do like a lot of like work on myself. I tried not to let it affect me as much, and I was going through like dietary changes. Like I stopped eating meat, which in hindsight probably wasn't a great idea. So I was losing a lot of weight from having a restricted diet,
okay,
which didn't help the body dysmorphic disorder.
So did it increase the speed of change?
I think so. Yeah, I've mapped it out on like I was saying, like I took a lot of photos of myself. So wow. Like I've been able to like map out some sense of timeline, and it's quite drastic in the way I used to look in, say, 2016 compared to before the tumor was taken out. Oh, I don't know how this is going to sound to like people who are watching this, because I'm not really like getting to the point. It feels like we're talking about something that no one knows about.
We're building a case study. This is an art house film. It's a slow burn.
It's a slow burn. Okay. I like it. No idea of the tumor in 2016.
Okay.
What I was aware of in 2016 was that I had body image issues, and I was losing a lot of weight through dietary changes. But I was also putting on muscle. I was working, I am still working, in retail industry as well, where it's a lot of physical work in a sense. It's a liquor store, so it's a warehouse. So it's a lot of walking, lifting, like a lot of like, and it's quite like a masculine environment as well. I guess the clientele, if you will, a lot of older men. So I think even the way I would interact with people was more masculine in a way.
Could you qualify that just a bit? Like the, like your speech patterns, the way you would joke around, how close you would get to people. I mean, just like on like an emotional or verbal level.
I think I was trying to match the, like, or mirror, the ways in which the customers, mostly being men, would communicate. So, mostly in terms of, I guess I would associate the way they would communicate with like more like bluntness, directness, even the way I would hold myself, or I would get, but also the way I was treated as well. I get a lot of like, "Hey mate, how you going?" So like more like neutral, like it wasn't like, I was like, "Hey love, how are you?" Like even the way I was being treated was different, but that's kind of normal anyway. Like I'm not saying they were treating me different by how I looked, because I don't think they're aware of how they communicate either. Anyway, it's all complicated.
Yeah.
Where were we going? So we're moving to like 2017 now, I think. And I still wasn't studying. I was still working, but I wasn't really doing much. Like I wasn't exploring. I wasn't going after things. I wasn't really expressing myself. I was kind of just like going through the motions. But I did meet someone I worked with, and she is a lesbian, I should say. And I felt really connected to her. And I think that was also a sense of validation for myself, in that I feel really connected to this person. We have a lot of similar qualities. We have a lot of similar experiences. I must be this thing too. And because I had feelings for her as well, like that was confirmation in itself for me. Even though I never really did anything with those feelings, because inability to express myself.
Do you mind telling me what those feelings were, like an obsession with somebody or just like a general warmth in their direction? Could you express the quality of that?
Yeah, it was more just like I wanted to spend time with her, and it seemed like she wanted to spend time with me as well. Feeling comfortable just to kind of do nothing with each other. I was quite anxious throughout the process as well, in terms of wanting to impress her, like I wanted her to have feelings for me too, I guess, but I was never willing to do that. But I was also recognizing at the time that, like, I probably didn't fit what she was looking for in a way, because I think I was starting to recognize, like, hey, I'm not really like this feminine person. I think I was starting to not really see myself as a woman at that point. I never really stopped identifying with being a woman, but it was more like, I don't think outside of people, or like the public, were seeing me how I saw myself. So I'd have interactions with customers where I could tell they were kind of confused about my presentation in a way. Like, at this time I was very like flat-chested, lost a lot of weight, you know, build up of muscle, hair growth, deeper voice. I cut my hair shorter, and I remember having this interaction with a customer where he was like, he didn't know how to address me, like ma'am or sir or whatever he was trying to say, but he was quite rude about it in a sense. And he was just like, I just don't know what you are. Like, I can't figure you out or something.
He said that directly
to me. Huh. Yeah. That's paraphrasing. I can't remember the exact dialogue, but along the lines of that. But his wife was very embarrassed.
How did you react to that, to hearing that?
I was kind of just like, okay. Like, I didn't really correct him, and I didn't try to educate him. I was in my place of work, and I didn't want to start something. And I think that comes from a sense of politeness and anti-conflict, and not really wanting to make a big deal out of things. So my personality traits coming into it at the same time. But I was offended, and it did stick with me.
Okay.
Quite a bit. Especially because I was worrying about the same thing. Like, that's when I started realizing, like, I don't know, maybe, yeah, like, is that how everyone else is seeing me? Is that how I see myself?
Did that initiate some sort of, like, hardcore self-inventory or looking inside yourself? Or I guess you already said that it kind of boosted up what you were already thinking, but did that, like, form a crux or a change in your direction or thinking?
I think I was, yes and no. Like, I think I was aware of it, but also unwilling to do anything about it. So I remember, like I was saying, like, I don't live with my family, and I wasn't seeing them that often. I'd go home and see them every couple months. But when I would see them, like, every time they would see me, I looked different, like, every time.
Would they remark on that?
So my mum was probably more vocal about it, and she was like, you know, like, you should get yourself checked out. I think she was pointing out the fact that, you know, you have more hair than you used to, or I think she just sort of was saying, you know, you look different. Or, and at that time I was presenting myself differently as well. Like, I stopped wearing, like, feminine clothes. Like, not that I really was overly wearing dresses and skirts all the time. I would occasionally, but I was, like, almost exclusively shopping in the boys' clothes section, or men's clothes section, I should say.
And was there an intention behind that?
I think it was more at that time.
Was it just a feeling of...
I think the intention was, I wanted, although I still identified being female, and, like, I think people still viewed me as that. Maybe people just need to take, like, a second look at me to really figure it out. Like, I think if you were just passing me by, you'd probably clock me as, like, a guy at the time. But maybe if we were to have a conversation or actually speak, it'd be less, I don't know. But I think what I was trying to do was perform in a way. So like being at the time I identified as a lesbian, I guess I saw myself as more of like that, like, you know, how there's like femme lesbians and butch lesbians.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was more like leaning towards like the butch end of the spectrum based off how I looked. And also at the time, though, the clothes that I guess gender non-conforming women wear, i.e. men's clothing, it fit me better as well because my body was accommodating to
did
that.
Did it fit your feelings too? Your feeling of self, like that, that's just how you fit into the world better. It kind of just conformed you to the world.
Yeah. It felt comfortable at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It felt like I was figuring myself out. Like, I think, yeah, I saw it as just me being like gender non-conforming, and why should I have to anyway? Like, I think there was like a political agenda behind it.
Oh, okay.
'Cause I was aware of like the social politics at play in that, or I had an understanding of it in terms of, at that time I was more along the lines of thinking gender is a social construct and in the end doesn't really matter if like a female wears male clothing. It's hard to articulate, so it's probably not coming out right. And even in terms of not removing body hair, so like growing out leg hair and armpit hair and not really putting in any effort to remove that, I think I saw as a sign of me rejecting like patriarchal notions of womanhood.
Yeah, yeah.
Not as, hey, something could be wrong here.
Hmm. Were you growing like a goatee or a facial
hair? No, that was like the one thing I was still trying to not have. So like I wouldn't shave or anything, but like I was saying earlier when we're talking about like compulsions around body dysmorphic disorder, like a lot of just like I would just like almost subconsciously like start like picking at it, trying to remove it. But I think that ended up being like a losing battle in a way, because the more testosterone my body was producing, the harder it was to really maintain. And I think I just kind of I got into my head that because no one was pointing it out to me, really. Like, no one was saying, hey, like, looks like you're growing a beard or something. And I wasn't, but I'm being dramatic about it. Because no one was, like, directly pointing it out. I thought I was also just imagining it. Like, it was a part of, like, the mental illness aspect of it.
Okay.
Like, a part of body dysmorphic disorder is that the fixation you have on a part of your body, it's, I'm not saying it's make-believe, but because you're hyper-fixated on it, you're not seeing yourself the way other people see you. So a part of the therapy behind that is like,
letting it go, or?
Yeah, like...
Because it seems almost like the diagnosis of body dysmorphia allowed you to ignore a problem.
Yes. Yes,
and,
exactly.
And it's almost the solution to that is to use it as a way of ignoring.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, almost. Like I was like, you know, you're overthinking it. It's probably not as bad as you think it really is because no one's pointed it out to you. So, you know, let's just keep living in denial. But so we get to like later in 2017. And
one more question, because I know that testosterone boosts people's libido. Did you see an increase in physical desire in step with the other changes going on?
Somewhat. Kind of. I think, I don't know if I really had an increase in libido. Maybe I did. But I think the way I viewed my attraction is different. So, like, this girl I worked with who I had feelings for, And I hope she never sees this, because that would be just really embarrassing. I think, like, maybe, like, the fantasies I had, or if I was to let myself think that we could be, like, a couple. I think the way I viewed, like, potential sexual encounters was always me being more dominant, or... But before that, I don't really think I viewed myself as like a dominant kind of person in a sexual kind of way. Not that, I don't want to get into that kind of stuff, because I don't.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if there's just a change. Like, we don't need to get into the details, but
I think it was more just like
concentration of your.
Yeah, I think, the way I viewed myself in like a sexual way was probably different to how I used to. But like I was saying at the start, I didn't really have much of a like fixed sense of a sexual identity or like even attraction or desire, so everything felt new. Like I didn't really have much to compare it to, so even then it made it difficult to really know who I was and
or where you're headed.
This is what I mean, like identity is just like a focal point of this. So in 2017, so this was in I think September 2017, I crashed my car, which doesn't seem like a big deal in relation to this, but I had like a minor meltdown about it. I don't think I was dealing very well with my anxiety and other things happening, so that I guess was a turning point because it propelled me to take action. So I organized an appointment with a counselor at a mental health service we have in the area. So I met with a community health nurse and I was referred to an intake assessment with a general practitioner. So this service is a mental health and physical health. It's a combined service. And you can self-refer and there's easy access points. So if you're having difficulty with mental health and you're aged between, I can't remember the exact ages, like 10 and 25, for example, you can go there and you're entitled to confidentiality. You can talk about issues with a counselor or a psychologist or for a broad range of problems. So I knew about this service and I made myself an appointment, but there's a long waiting list for those reasons because it's free and it's for young people and young people have issues.
And not a lot of money, so.
And exactly. So I waited a bit for that appointment and my intention to go was to start really trying to figure out my anxiety, because I think my responses to things at the time were quite over dramatic in a sense, like crashing my car, although no one was hurt, nothing really bad happened, but I think I overreacted in a way. Like I didn't feel like myself, like something like that shouldn't have hurt me as much as it did, I guess. So that propelled me to take action. But the GP I saw after like a month or so of booking the appointment, or was it the nurse? I don't remember who made the notes, but they, although I was seeking mental health advice, they noted that, I think the term for it is like hirsutism, which is like male-like hair growth on the face or body.
Okay.
Being hirsute, I think, is the term. So they noted that in the assessment, although I didn't really go for that. And I'd seen GPs in the past, but no one had really made note of it. So this nurse or doctor, whoever I saw, did. So from there, it was discussed and family history was discussed and trying to track if I had any other hormonal issues, like in terms of menstrual cycle or other things that can happen with hormonal issues. Like there's a disorder, polycystic ovarian syndrome, where females have it. And one of the symptoms or one of the diagnostic criteria is increased hair growth or male-like hair growth. But there's also other elements to be diagnosed with that. Like, it's usually in women who are overweight, or there's other elements.
Yeah, so there's other stressors that can initiate that system.
Yeah. So they were trying to, I guess, figure out what the hell was going on. So I was.
But they knew something was going on, and they told you that something's going on. So you knew that something was going on at this point.
I think that's when I was just like, oh, like, you know, a doctor's telling me this, like, probably should look into it. Even then, like, I mean, I probably already knew, but I didn't want to do anything about it because there was a lot of, I guess, shame regarding it. Like, I was embarrassed, I guess, because I don't know, like, I think the hair growth in particular was what I was quite embarrassed about. And I didn't really want to tell someone about it because, like, would it, I think I had in my head, like, if nothing was wrong with me, then I just look like this naturally, and I didn't want that either. I don't know. So I was booked. Do you have questions? Do you want me to keep going?
No, keep on going. We're almost to the there's a knife or a scanner or something coming up here.
Yeah.
Some medical technology is going to happen.
Yeah. So I was booked in to have an ultrasound, and from the ultrasound, they, I think, wanted to assess my ovaries to see if they were polycystic. And I think the person who was doing it, I don't know her title, she asked if she could do, like, a transvaginal procedure, which is, like, they have, like, this wand thing, and they, like, stick it up, yeah, and they, like, assess on an internal level if there's something else going on. I probably could talk about this with more respect, but oh well.
Hey, it's your canal, so speak it literally as you would.
Anyway, so from there, I think it was documented that there was an area of concern or an area that needed to be investigated. So I did a lot of blood work. Like, I got very used to just, yeah, having a needle in my arm, I guess, and other kinds of, yeah, like, they were, I don't know, they, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, like, what they were really looking for, but I got a call from the general practitioner, and I think she was the one that discussed the potential of there being a tumor. She had access to, like, medical imaging, but that was then deemed out of her scope, so she had to refer me on, and that's when I met an endocrinologist. So yeah, I met him in November when the GP was out of scope,
and that's this tumor somewhere in your womanly regions then?
No, actually. It was on my right adrenal gland, so the adrenal glands sit above the kidneys. But there are cases, which are more common, I believe, where the tumor is somewhere in the ovary region, and they're usually referred to, I believe, a gynecologist rather than an endocrinologist. But I was referred to an endocrinologist, where more medical imaging was done, so like a CT and an MRI, more blood work. More blood work, and that's, I think, when I first met with him, he had an inkling of what it could be, but yeah, they needed more imaging to diagnose. So I think the second time I saw him, he was like, yeah, we think you have a pure androgen secreting adrenal tumor, which
a pure androgen secreting
androgen secreting adrenal tumor. Yeah, that's what it did. It just predominantly, exclusively only produced male hormones.
And is this congenital? This is just a random kind of freak growth kind of thing? Does it come from anywhere? Do we know?
It just happened. Yeah, good question. Okay. It just naturally occurring in a way. But I remember my first appointment with the endocrinologist, and he was like, you could pass as a boy. Like, if he was... because he's in that professional field, he could recognize the signs, but on like a social scale of things, like, and to the public, I was probably being clocked as a boy. And I was also, like I was saying, like dressing in a masculine way. Like I was trying to like
top of it all. Yeah.
Fit.
Was your tumor producing a lot of androgens?
Yeah. It doesn't mean much to me because I'm not an endocrinologist. So testosterone, the reference range for a female, for example, is between like 0.2 and 1.8. And mine was at 6.2.
Oh, geez.
I don't know what kind of measurement that is on. Like, it's like some micromilliliter. Okay,
yeah. And like, do you know what that compares to a boy in your situation or a male? Do you have that number on hand?
No, I don't have that number.
But it's way above the female range.
Way above. And like DHEAS, which is another androgen. So normal range 1.0 to 11.7, and mine was at 47.1. So,
jeez.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what that means on a scale of things, but
yeah,
definitely above what it should be in a healthy range.
Yeah.
So I think my endocrinologist was quite, I wouldn't say excited, but some kind of, I think he wanted to work with me because it was so rare and he hadn't come across something like that. I think it was only like, he'd read about it, and there's not much, because I remember having a lot of questions for him, but he would have to like say, you know, there's not a lot of, there's not the greatest deal of information about this. Like, I don't have all the answers for you. But one of the first questions, or one of the first things I thought about when it was like official, when they're like, yeah, you have this tumor and it's creating like a disproportionate amount of testosterone in your body. One of the first questions I had was like, is the tumor the reason why I'm gay?
You said that out loud.
I think I did ask him. I don't remember what response I got, but that was like the main area of concern I had. I thought going through the surgery, because surgery is the intervention you have to get rid of it. I thought that would steal it from me. In a way, like being gay, because I thought I'd come through this whole journey of it all, like, this is how I identify, like, I feel like comfortable in myself in that regard, and like I dress this specific way and this means that and all these things.
This whole network of identity had been built up.
If that
tumor took that away, then you would have to start all over again, or
that was where I was coming from.
Okay.
But I mean, I think when I first made contact with you, I mentioned something like, you know, I feel like I have a unique experience with this, but I don't really know if that's the case, because when I was recovering from surgery, there's like a polycystic ovarian syndrome. So PCOS is the acronym, and there's like a subreddit. And I remember typing in PCOS and lesbian, or PCOS and gay. And because one of the symptoms of that syndrome is increased testosterone, I wasn't the only one that had feelings about my sexuality being informed by my hormone levels. So that was reassuring in a way. But, I mean, it's not uncommon, I think, for females with high levels of testosterone to have a complicated relationship with sexuality, or at least an uncertainty. Which is sad, but
how is that sad?
I don't know. I think I'm now at a place where it's just like, just be whatever you want.
Okay.
Or maybe it comes from a place where these people might be looking for answers, and those answers they might not find, and it's better just to accept your feelings at the time and don't put too much pressure on the fact that those feelings could change. So I was terrified that my identity would be taken away from me. But, you know, I was also gladly rational enough at the time that I knew I had to go through with the surgery. There was a moment where, like, I was quite defiant, and I met with another general practitioner, and I was just like, I don't believe I have a tumor. Like, I'm not doing this. And like, surgery was like 4 days later or something.
Oh, geez.
But
okay.
It all happened quite quickly. I was pretty lucky in like, in terms of our public health system where, you know, I had all this imaging done free of charge, basically met with an endocrinologist who probably took sympathy upon me, and I was lucky I didn't have to have any financial stress in that regard. And I was, I think, fast forwarded through like a surgical waiting list due to issues.
The immediacy of your issue. Yeah. What about the other side effects? So there's body hair and then kind of bone structure and then perhaps psychological stuff. I guess we'll get to how that changed perhaps some of your anxiety or depression, but also your sexuality. But are there other long-term adverse effects of that tumor on you? Like, was your reproductive system going through weirdness? Was there other...
So I was still menstruating, which my endocrinologist found quite unusual.
Okay, so that's pretty unusual.
But I'm still getting my period. Yeah. Okay. But I don't think I was ovulating. So although I was still like bleeding, I don't think I was fertile at the time. Mm-hmm. I think, if that's the right terminology around it. It was a whole learning experience. and so, yeah, I don't really know if there's many long-term effects other than the fact that I still have polycystic ovaries, which a long-term effect of that could be fertility issues. But I think in the case study, like, it was proposed that polycystic ovaries is secondary to the tumor. So the tumor may be...
What do you mean secondary? So...
That the polycystic ovaries is an effect of having the tumor, maybe for the amount of time it was there or the stress it put on. Like,
and so you did have or do have polycystic ovaries, which I have to just use my basic Latin to say that you have many cysts upon your ovaries. Is that what that means?
Yeah.
Which is a separate condition that's secondary to the tumor, was removed, probably pretty simply. Was that an outpatient surgery or a couple days in the hospital?
It was keyhole surgery, so it was quite non-invasive compared to other forms of surgery.
Okay.
They removed the adrenal gland as well as the tumor due to the way the tumor was sitting on the adrenal gland. They couldn't. And because your body, like with kidneys, can function with just one.
Okay.
But the reason I stayed in hospital maybe a little bit longer was because I think something to do with cortisol or another stress hormone or adrenaline. They had to run tests and I couldn't go home straight away because I don't think they could just send me home and not be certain of the hormonal effect it could have had. That all happened quite suddenly and rapidly.
And I remember, what was the effect? Sorry, you were saying you remember what?
That's okay. Like I was saying before, like, I just remember like joking with friends, that when like the tumor is removed, maybe I won't be gay anymore. Ha ha ha. Even though I didn't want that to be the truth, I think I was just putting it out there, maybe, but hey, who knows? But in regards to the effect, what do you mean?
Did it change your mood? Did it change your outlook on life?
When I had it removed?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's physical changes that occurred afterwards, but what were the emotional changes?
Yeah, okay. So my anxiety began to reduce, felt more in control. I returned back to studying after a year and a half, probably away from it. I began to speak more, express myself, talk more openly about experiences. I became more in tune with my surroundings and emotions. I was making
more
decisions. And other people, yeah. Wait, is being more in tune with other people, is that what you mean? I wasn't as isolated or reserved. I mean, I still kind of am that way, but less of it. I was making more decisions about my future. I became less concerned with the outsider's perception of myself. So those kinds of things, definitely, I started to notice. It wasn't quickly, just gradually over time. Mm-hmm. But I think I had high hopes, I think. I thought because the testosterone was quite quick to go back into normal ranges, I think I thought that meant that the symptoms that come with high levels of testosterone would reduce just as quickly, but it doesn't work that way. So I think I was still quite conscious and finding it quite difficult to accept maybe some of the long-term or potential permanent changes it had on my body.
Did you have somebody to talk to about that? Friend that you can...
Yeah, I lived with housemates at the time, and I had like a quite solid friend base, and my sister, the triplet sister, we have like a more close connection compared to me and my other siblings, and I found it easier to talk to her about it than most people. And like, she's gone through her own issues regarding identity as well, like I don't know, two sides of the same coin almost. She struggled a lot with like eating disorder stuff and still does, and that too creates a lot of changes within the self and the physical form and concerns about perception. So we had similar issues with identity, but came from different places.
Yeah. I think. Because you had a purely androgen secreting tumor.
Yes.
And you're not sure if your sister's a twin, identical twin or not.
Yeah.
Was there a pretty strong divergence of you between you physically that you can attribute to the injection of androgens into your system? Did you guys start looking more and more different at that point?
Did I start looking different? Yeah.
From her?
Yeah, I started looking more like my brother.
Huh.
Like, and I'd never really been compared to him much before, but when I came home, like, throughout the year or so, I get more and more comments about it. Like, oh, you look like him. I'm like, yeah, I do. But, yeah. But we have similar features now. We looked quite, it was hard to tell us apart growing up, but I think as we both went through a lot of changes in regards to our physical form through different reasons. I think that's kind of had like long-term effects, and I don't know if we really will look as similar as we used to, which is sad almost. But like, it's good in a way because maybe we're more distinguishable, and maybe that's something I wanted in, I don't know. It's,
That's just fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a whole level of self-reflection that,
yeah.
I mean, literal self-reflection that you have in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you had somebody that you had people that you could talk through this stuff, the post-surgery and kind of come to terms or discover or explore these different, I guess it's another puberty in a way. It's another physical change, probably with a lot of emotional weirdness and stuff going on.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, I became more, although I had people around me, I did become more like self-reflective. I guess trying to document or at least journal stuff. More my emotional state. I think I became less concerned with the reverse physical effects.
You said you did a whole bunch of pictures before then. Did you kind of stop taking pictures after then?
No, I kept doing that. I think, I still do that.
Is there like a flip book that you're going to release at some point in your life? Like, watch
me maybe.
Change.
Yeah, I showed my endocrinologist the other day just because I wanted Yeah, I feel like I'd be interested in it. Just to map the changes. Yeah, make a flip book. That's a good idea.
You're still seeing an endocrinologist. And
yep. So
is he helping you regulate these things, and you're just doing daily checkups or, I guess, monthly checkups or something like that?
Not daily or monthly. At the moment, I'm doing more, seeing him on a six-month basis.
Okay.
And I do more blood tests, but that's to see if I'm still within normal range or if there's any areas of concern.
Mm-hmm.
I still, maybe, I've probably done more like CT MRIs since, but just one of each. And I still meet with a surgical team as well. So I still keep in touch with all the people who help me out.
Wait, why do you meet with a surgical team regularly? Just to get poked at? They just like, yeah, we'll just look inside of you.
Do you mind? They don't even do that. I think because of the unusual...
Okay.
Although the tumor was benign, it was active. So I think there was still concern of malignancy.
Okay.
So they did pathology reports and stuff about... It's, I don't know, like the cells stuff. I don't know, whatever it was. It kind of flies over my head a bit. Like, I wish I could understand more, but, like, it's not really one of those things that's easy to understand.
Yeah, yeah.
And
when was the surgery? How long ago was that?
18 months ago.
So I had it. So a year and a half then.
Yeah, February of 2018.
Okay.
And I guess that year, like I went back to studying, I was getting more of a grip on reality and myself. But I was still quite confident in the fact I was a lesbian.
Okay.
And I was kind of relieved. I was just like, oh yeah, like, haha, suckers, like you all thought. I was gonna pull a 180 or 360 or something.
And you're talking to the voices in your head, not so much your society, or is it?
yeah. And like, that's kind of what I thought other people were thinking as well.
Okay. Yeah. Huh.
Like, I think the anxiety of it, I was like, oh, they're all thinking that because I've had this happen to me, that it's going to result in this, and just, anxiety about it. But I did start questioning my sexuality more towards the end of 2018. So that was almost 1 year after surgery. And because I was becoming more in tune with myself and recognizing or being more aware of like my behavior and thoughts, I think I did probably start to recognize that maybe I wasn't exclusively attracted to women. Because that became more obvious when I realized I probably was like developing feelings for a guy. And I think I recognized that, not in so much ways of sexual attraction, because that's something I've never really had like much of a grasp on, but it was more on like a level of emotional like intimacy, like wanting to share parts of myself with this person. In a way I wouldn't really do to just random people or maybe even friends.
Was this surprising for you?
Yeah, it was surprising. And I didn't really know what to do with it. Like, I think I found myself thinking about him a lot. But it was also weird at the time as well, because I was still presenting, I guess, more on like that butch female spectrum of things. So it was kind of like, even though I was like realizing I had feelings for him, I was also like, oh, well, I think I got myself stuck in like a lot of, it's hard to describe, like, because I presented the way I did, it was just like, well, he's not going to have feelings for me if I look like this.
Okay.
Even though that kind of doesn't fully encapsulate the complexity of sexuality, because
the human being or I mean
and
totally mating with somebody other than just physically, like really partnering with somebody,
but like the physicality of things became, I guess, quite a focal point. Mm-hmm. But I think as soon as like I could admit to myself, like, hey, like, you're probably not a lesbian and that's okay. And I think I was more worried about having to retell a story again. Like, I didn't come out to everyone, and I was throughout the years tempted to like do the whole public coming out and just tell everyone, and why not, and freedom for all.
Yeah, so more of a political act.
Yeah,
rather than a personal affirmation.
Yeah, and I think the public act, in my eyes, could have resulted in personal affirmation, but I never went through with it.
Okay.
I did think about it. I was like, oh, but at the same time, like, I was still reserved and quite private, and it didn't really seem it would fit myself if I was just to make some public service announcement on Facebook or something. Like, yeah, it would be quite unfitting. But as soon as I could like recognize it, it like flipped a switch, I guess. Like, I just, it didn't really matter anymore, almost. Like, all those concerns I had about having to retell a story and being judged on the fact that I didn't have like a stable sense of identity, like, it just kind of washed away in a sense.
What would that matter anyways, if you had a stable identity? I mean, other than, I understand for yourself, like, knowing who you are, but
no,
like, this whole idea of social identity seems pretty prevalent in just in your generation, like in the Facebook generation. And this is what I am. This is how you categorize me. But I guess at some point you realized, after wrestling with it, that what does it really amount to?
Exactly. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, no, what matters is, like, you're a good person, I guess. It just, I don't know, maybe it is a generational thing. Like, we're more obsessed with this idea of labeling through a means of understanding the other, maybe. Like, if you say you're this thing, then maybe people will understand you more, but that doesn't really help anyone understand anyone, you know. Like, it's more about having conversation and finding things in common or not in common, and it's about more than just a label you ascribe to yourself. Like,
well, and the adventure of investigating and being investigated by another human being, which we could call love or romance, that mm-hmm. whole quest can be sort of encapsulated by these identities just to get through the door, but there's so much more to a human being once you initiate that relationship, and where that could possibly go and what level you can get to with another human being will never be able to fit inside those categories.
Yeah, like, I was so much more concerned with the label I would use and share with people, but I didn't really focus on like parts of myself or like personality traits or the more important parts, like being genuine and being honest and being kind and compassionate, like words I would use to describe myself, but not deeming them as important as some arbitrary label.
And once you were free of that, where did your attention go? Once you were free, I guess, specifically of, am I a lesbian? Am I gay? Am I not?
Yeah.
What's that? It seems like you described a moment where that became a non-issue.
Yeah. I think
where did
I
your
was
attention
just
start going?
Well, I think I did become like more fixated or along the lines of that with this male I was thought I had feelings for. So that took up a portion, but I think the sense of freedom I found within myself, I just felt more inclined to dedicate myself to more things. I felt like I could just do more. So I started like working more and studying more and researching more and all of that.
Researching what?
I like all this stuff. I like looking into like sexuality, gender, identity, and looking into similar cases like mine, mental health sides of things. I don't know, all that stuff. Like, it's been very interesting for me to watch your videos and look into people who have, yeah, like I was saying when I first got in contact with you about feeling like the terminology around transition and detransition, it felt like I could use it in a sense, because maybe in a way I have been doing that. Like, although I wouldn't probably describe myself as having like gender dysphoria, it's not like I ever really stopped identifying with like my womanhood, but I think the mechanisms at play are quite similar in that testosterone has effects and I experience that, and then on both ends. And I think that's why I probably, yeah, found some sense of comfortability with other women who have detransitioned in a way, although we've come from two different places, maybe.
Do you think that you have anything that you could possibly say to women who are going through a shift in identity about how to put their attention or where you think focusing your attention could have gone towards a productive, I guess, development of yourself?
I think part of the human condition is wanting acceptance. And I think that's something I always wanted, because at the other end of acceptance is rejection. And to be rejected is to be on the outside, and we all want to be on the inside. But you have to start with yourself, I think.
You think you've got a place to be accepting of yourself? Do you think that's kind of returned to you, or that you've earned that at this point?
Yeah, I've earned it. I think so, after everything, I've earned it. And there's definitely things I still think about, and like things I still struggle with, like in terms of body, and I mean, even just the effects of testosterone, like hair on my face and stuff. And I don't know if that's ever going to be completely back to how I was before all these hormonal changes started occurring. But I remember coming across, because I was sort of into the whole politics or maybe discourse around women who are gender nonconforming, or maybe through even a feminist lens, that there's these conversations about, you know, it's valid to have body hair and, you know, you don't have to shave or remove it, or, you know, it's great to accept yourself as you are, which I totally agree with. Mm-hmm. But I think I ignore the fact that there could be also hormonal reasons. I think that's such an important thing, is I'm not saying that everyone who has dark, coarse body hair has a hormonal issue.
I see what you're saying.
But
Just like that diagnosis of body dysmorphia allowed you to ignore things, like the diagnosis or the cure of self-acceptance can be used to ignore things too. So it's important to step outside of the diagnosis or the cure or the problem in order to look at honestly where you are, what's going on with your body.
Yeah, and that's where it comes in, like, you know, just check in with yourself. Or if you can't check in with yourself, I think the important message through this, I guess you could say, is and this speaks to more of like the medical community, I guess, but with general practitioners or primary healthcare providers, like the first people you see, whether it be a doctor or a nurse or something, need to be able to identify these things. Like I was saying, like I saw other GPs and no one had noted that there could be something wrong. And it wasn't until things got to where they were that something was done about it. And like, I'm very lucky and grateful and fortunate that I met some very intelligent people, medical professionals, that were able to help me. But I think, well, in the case study, the key message was the importance of co-located primary mental and it's having like mental and physical healthcare combined.
Okay, yeah.
And the importance of that, because I did present with anxiety and that was my main concern, but they could see beyond that and see that there was something else going on. So body and mind. They work together in a complicated format, like very complicated. And I don't think I'm ever going to be able to understand it or coherently talk about it. But
they're rather inextricable, at least so far as we know them to be in this world.
Yeah, definitely.
And no matter how far we run away from that, too.
Exactly.
Did you just put on boots?
Yeah. How did you know that?
I could just tell. I don't know why.
It was all like the movements. I'm lacing them up.
There's something going on down there.